It's great to be here with you all again this morning. Really appreciate the opportunity. And I bring you greetings from your sister congregation in what was this morning the sunshine of Hood River. At some point in our lives, most of us have probably had to memorize these famous words from the Declaration of Independence, written, I might note, by our own Unitarian forebear, Thomas Jefferson. You all know them. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness. Did you ever stop to wonder where that phrase came from? Or how it came to appear in no less a document than our Declaration of Independence, right up there alongside life and liberty? Well, I have wondered. And so, as I often do when I start to wonder about a subject, I volunteered to do a sermon about it, a surefire way to prod me to dig a little bit deeper. Naturally, I turned first to the internet. A UU sermon that I found online shed some light on my question. As most of us know, our founding fathers were men of the Enlightenment, and yes, they were pretty much men. Traditional Christian authorities had taught that human beings were meant to suffer in this life, enduring this veil of tears, the better to prepare for the joys of the world to come. But Enlightenment humanists like Jefferson rejected that grim belief. They hearkened back instead to the wisdom of the ancient Greek philosophers who had argued that leading a happy life was the natural goal of human beings. Aristotle, for example, put happiness front and center, proclaiming that happiness is the meaning and purpose of life, the whole aim and end of human existence. Well, along with the ancient Greeks and our enlightened founding fathers, we Unitarian Universalists typically focus on living life to the fullest in this world, the only life we know for sure that we're going to get. And I suspect that most of us would agree with Aristotle that our desire for happiness is normal and natural, nothing for which we have any need to apologize. But then another question emerges. What exactly is this happiness that we so naturally seek? My trusty Webster's defines happiness as having a feeling of great pleasure, contentment, or joy. Happiness, then, according to this common definition, is a feeling. From this, we might well deduce that whatever gives us the most pleasure will result in the greatest happiness. That sounds pretty reasonable. And so we find ourselves pursuing more. More money, more freedom, more love, more health, more sex, more fun. If only I had a little more X, we tend to think I could be a truly happy person. But I think most of us know in our heart of hearts that there's something wrong with this picture. As our reading this morning suggested, constantly chasing after pleasure actually backfires in the wrong one. And it's not just our intuitive knowledge or watching old episodes from the Twilight Zone that supports this understanding. In recent years, a number of psychologists have gotten tired of our discipline's rather single-minded focus on pathology and dysfunction. They've decided that it might be more helpful to try to figure out what actually makes people happy. The results of this research are illuminating. Let's start with money. We all know that a certain minimal level of material well-being is necessary for any quality of life. The desperate mother in war-torn Africa, watching her children slowly starve to death because she cannot provide food for them, would stare at us with blank incomprehension if we were to inquire about her level of happiness. But once you have enough money, research suggests that more isn't necessarily better. Rich people, in fact, are not significantly happier than those of more modest means. And the United States, the wealthiest country in the history of the world, is far from the top on the scale of international surveys of happiness. The relationship between happiness and income is, in fact, quite modest and disappears entirely above a certain level. Actually, once your basic needs have been met, what matters seems to be not how much wealth or how many toys you have, but rather the relationship between your income and your aspirations. There are always more things out there that people can find to want. And if you look around and compare yourself to those who have more than you do, and unless you are Bill Gates, you will always find such people, then you're dooming yourself to a life of dissatisfaction. On the other hand, people who live in gratitude for what they have, rather than focusing on what they don't have, can be happy with surprisingly modest amounts of money. It seems that the key to happiness lies more with our attitude than with our income. So, as our grandmothers probably told us, money can't buy happiness. But what about all those other pleasures that we find ourselves chasing after? Take free time. Most of us dream that if we won the lottery, we'd immediately quit our jobs and sail off to the South Seas, there to indulge in a life of unbridled pleasure. But in fact, as our earlier reading suggested, even fun can get old after a while. Sure, we all need some of it, but more isn't necessarily better. Well, what about freedom? Well, again, freedom is good, but lack of any boundaries can leave us floundering and confused. What about choices? Well, anyone who has ever navigated the thicket of dozens of supplemental Medicare plans, as I recently did, or encountered the absolutely bewildering array of features on the latest electronic gadgets can tell you that there is definitely such a thing as too many choices. Actually, the most recent research suggests that external events have a surprisingly modest impact on our level of happiness over the long run. Yes, an unexpected stroke of good fortune will generally increase our happiness for a while, a surprisingly short while, as it turns out. Look at all the cautionary tales we hear about the disasters that end up befalling those who win huge lottery jackpots. And of course, on the other side of the coin, the loss of a loved one or a serious health problem will certainly make us deeply unhappy for a while. But after a period of adjustment, most of us will return to our accustomed set point of happiness, which for most people is in the mildly positive range. Even people afflicted with a catastrophic health event like quadriplegia eventually report levels of happiness equivalent to those of able-bodied people. So looking to events outside ourselves to make us happy is not likely to work, nor is blaming these events for our long-term unhappiness likely to be productive. And constantly chasing after happiness by pursuing greater and greater pleasures or more stuff is ultimately going to be a losing proposition. Well, we might conclude, it appears that we're simply stuck with whatever level of happiness our own personal set point happens to be. Great if that is positive, not so great if it's negative. But maybe the typical equation of happiness with pleasure fails to tell the whole story. The Roman Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius had a very different point of view, one that I think we might want to consider. The happiness and unhappiness of the rational social animal, he wrote, depends not on what he feels, but on what he does. Think about this. Ultimately, our happiness is less affected by what we feel, which is something that's generally outside of our conscious control, than by what we do, something that we in fact have considerable capacity to change. According to the Stoics, happiness is the result not of hedonistic excess, but of what Aristotle has termed eudaimonia, or a well-lived life. The well-lived life. Sigmund Freud had something very insightful to say about that. To be healthy, he said, a person really needs to be able to do only two things, to love and to work. Pretty simple. And psychological research confirms that given adequate satisfaction of one's basic needs, love and work are indeed the keys to happiness. Let's start with love. Virtually every research study I've seen supports the idea that connections with other people are central to happiness. We differ, of course, on how many people we would prefer to have in our lives. Some sociable souls thrive in the midst of a large network of friends, family members, and acquaintances, while other more introverted types are comfortable with only a few close relationships. But few of us can be happy in total isolation. We are by nature social animals. Now, when we think of love, most of us naturally focus on getting it or on having our needs met, to use the 1970s buzzwords. If we don't have anyone around to love us, we are convinced, then we are doomed to a life of misery. But in fact, some recent research suggests that giving support to other people is even more strongly related to happiness than is receiving support. The most effective methods of increasing happiness seem to be those that involve reaching out to others in positive ways, engaging in what the Buddhists call the practice of loving kindness. We don't have to sit around just waiting for love to come our way. We can be proactive and start the process by reaching out ourselves with love and compassion. In a related vein, it appears that the world's happiest people generally display a sense of basic trust in those around them. Rather than approaching others with cynicism and suspicion, they expect to be met with common decency. And as a result, they often are. There's a great example of this in a fascinating book called The Geography of Bliss, written by NPR correspondent Eric Weiner. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that book, but it's great. In researching this book, Weiner visited countries from Iceland to Qatar, from Switzerland to Bhutan, trying to identify the factors that make people in some countries generally happy, while those in others are miserable. One of the most miserable countries in the world turns out to be the former Soviet Republic of Moldova. Now, Moldova isn't a rich country, but it isn't a terribly poor one either. Plenty of people in countries with less material wealth are significantly happier than the Moldovans. But what Weiner discovered was that the people in Moldova viewed the world through a lens of cynicism, suspicion, and mistrust. They did not trust each other, their social institutions, or their government, especially their government. And with good reason, given the horrors of the Soviet regime, followed by the massive corruption of the post-Soviet era. But the cynicism with which Moldovans understandably viewed the world and each other was absolutely corrosive. Not much room there for the practice of loving kindness or for the emergence of happiness. After love comes work, engagement in an activity that feels meaningful and productive, that uses our talents, develops our potential, and contributes in some way to the greater good. Some of this work is for pay. Most of us, after all, do have to earn a living. And many are lucky enough to be able to find employment that feels intrinsically meaningful, being paid to heal the sick, teach the young, discover new knowledge. But even more mundane work, done with pride and a positive attitude, contributes to society in one way or another. You know, the garbage has to be collected. The automobiles on the assembly line have to have their bolts tightened. The potholes need to be repaired. And if nothing else, the checker at the Walmart or the cashier at the Dairy Queen can lighten our mood on a grouchy day with a friendly smile and a cheerful attitude. But work, in the sense that I'm using it here, goes well beyond paid employment. We contribute to the well-being of our own families by the work that we do within our homes, raising children, preparing meals, creating an atmosphere of love and warmth. We work to alleviate some of the inequality and injustice that we perceive in the world around us through our volunteer efforts. We express the best that is within us through our creative endeavors, making art or music or poetry. All of these are forms of meaningful work, and all contribute to the well-lived life that is the basis of true happiness. I'm saving one of the most interesting research findings about happiness until last. Study after study has demonstrated that the practice of religion contributes significantly to personal happiness. The researchers reporting these results, most of them committed secularists, I suspect, seem almost embarrassed about these findings and tend to kind of fumble around trying to look for explanations. But this correlation between religion and happiness makes perfect sense to me. In my view, what all religions worth their name have in common is that they draw us out of our own egos and connect us with something larger. And research makes it clear that over-involvement in oneself or excessive rumination about one's needs, desires, and problems is destructive to happiness. Trying to pursue happiness by focusing on your own ego is like pouring water into a pitcher with a hole in the bottom. No matter how much you add, you can never fill it up. The individual, unconnected human ego is simply too limited, too fragile, and too finite to provide a firm foundation for happiness. Religion, on the other hand, is all about connection. The word itself has roots in the Latin word ligare, meaning to bind together. For many of us UUs, the image of the interdependent web is a powerful metaphor for expressing this profound sense of connection. When we contribute to the whole through our relationships and our activities, we're strengthening ourselves as well. Or, as our Unitarian forebear Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, happiness is a perfume that you cannot pour on others without getting a few drops on yourself. Now, none of this is to say that there's anything wrong with a little bit of pleasurable self-indulgence. In my view, our beautiful world is here to be enjoyed. So indulge in that decadent bar of dark chocolate every now and then, or even every day, they're telling us now. Sip a nice glass of Oregon Pinot Noir. Sit on the rocks above the ocean and watch the waves crash. Lose yourself in a beautiful piece of music. And maybe even allow yourself to buy that funky pair of shoes that have been calling to you for weeks. Just don't delude yourself into thinking that chasing after more and more of these pleasures will lead to perfect happiness. It won't. So I would have to disagree with Thomas Jefferson about the pursuit of happiness. Yes, it's natural for human beings to want to be happy, but modern psychological research and ancient religious wisdom agree that happiness is a process, not a place. Not a destination, but the attitude with which we travel. It's a natural byproduct of a life lived as a conscious and intentional member of an interdependent web, expanding our focus beyond our individual egos to incorporate our connections with other people and the natural world, and contributing to that whole as best we can. Let me share with you what Eric Weiner concluded after studying happy and unhappy societies around the world. These are his words. Money matters, but less than we think, and not in the way that we think. Family is important. So are friends. Envy is toxic. So is excessive thinking. Beaches are optional. Trust is not. Neither is gratitude. An important ingredient in the happy life is connecting to something larger than ourselves, recognizing that we are not mere blips on the cosmic radar screen, but part of something much bigger. Happiness is not a verb or a noun. It is a conjunction, connective tissue. Happiness is a conjunction. I really like that. Of course, none of us is going to be happy all the time. Sometimes we are depressed. Sometimes we're bored by seemingly endless routine. Sometimes we're overwhelmed by the demands placed on us. And sometimes we are downright flattened by the things that life throws at us. But I would like to suggest that happiness is a possibility for all of us. No matter what our circumstances, we can reach out to others with love and goodwill. We can contribute in ways large or small to the wider society. We can nurture our connections with that which is greater than us. And then, perhaps, when we least expect it, happiness may come, in the words of Nathaniel Hawthorne, like a butterfly which, when pursued, is always beyond your grasp, but which, if you sit down quietly, may alight on your shoulder unbidden. May it be so.